Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you are tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. The best way to do that is to follow me on X at Focused Compound. If you want to get access to investment write-ups from Jeff going all the way back to 2005, go to focuscompound.com and you could get access to all of that for free at our website. If you want to learn more about our money management services, we do run a hedge fund and a separate managed accounts firm. You can reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. Jeff, have you looked at US Lime at all recently? You originally wrote up this stock. Let's see if I can find it. I think I had passed maybe 2018, 2019. Let's see. US Lime, a high longevity stock in a low competition industry. The stock is up at like $300 per share now, if you could believe it.
Yeah, US Lime has re-rated a lot because of inflation and all that, I think. It's just a totally... And size. US Lime, when we talked about it, was a smaller company. And what happens a lot with microcap quality type things is that when they get bigger, people start to... Like, if you look at... What's the market cap on it now?
Okay, we could pull it up on QuickFS right here. Let's see. It's got to be a couple billion now, right? Yeah, 1.7 billion.
Right. And so it's not just that it went up, what is that, five times or something, but that moves it from being a microcap to being something that all sorts of people can invest in. Yeah. So, you can see it there. Good business. Obviously not a radically different business than it was back then. Price is the main difference. Price of the stock, but also price of the what they sell. Because of the fact that it's a, inflation protected generally.
I love the backdrop of a company though, like US Lime, or given the current market environment that we're in, it seems like anything that's attached to the periodic table is going to be a pretty good place to park some money because of inflation and everything that the Fed's doing. That's actually the topic of our conversation here today. Chairman Powell, they had their meeting yesterday. And there's been a lot of talks, right? We came into this year talking about how the market seemed to be priced to perfection. And we had a hot inflation print last week or the week before. So a lot of people were speculating that perhaps they were going to come out and say that they're not going to cut interest rates three times this year. And maybe Powell would roll those comments back. And it just doesn't seem like that's the case. So last meeting yesterday, it was much more of a dovish Powell. He's still talking about three rate cuts this year. And it seems like inflation is just going to scream again, just kind of looking at it. So I wanted to get your thoughts on it. Interest rates are, they were left unchanged. At least the Fed funds rate was left unchanged. I kind of am feeling like, real estate is still at all-time highs. There's a lot of companies and stocks, these junk companies that are starting to run again. Reddit just went public today for a pretty high valuation. It seems a lot like we're back in 2021. This time around, though, inflation is much more entrenched. You had said it's a lot easier going from, 9 to 3 than 3 to 2, and that seems to be the case here. I do wonder if they're going to almost change what their inflation target is, because it seems like it's going to be so hard going from 3 to 2. Fiscal spending is still out of this world. I do wonder if this is going to be like the Powell. It seemed like, in 2021, it was, nope, we're not going to raise rates. We're going to go super slow. We're going to be data dependent. And then he was reelected for chairman of the Fed, and it's like his next Fed presser, he came out and his demeanor, his tone, everything was just so different. I do wonder if there's an election put going on here or not. Like, why would they be still talking about rate cuts at these levels. It seems like everywhere I look, the economy is just humming along. Even their expectation for GDP was revised upwards. So wanted to hear your thoughts on this. It seems like anything that you could own, land, energy, anything attached to inflation or going to benefit from inflation seems like a really good spot to park some money.
Well, you can see in there, they do the dot plot, but they put out economic projections. What do they call it? The SEP? What do they call it?
Yeah.
I forget. Yeah.
Yeah.
Summary
of economic projections.
Okay. So the big difference is they have a much lower projection for the neutral rate, or let's call it, like, I don't know exactly how they define it, but the rate at which inflation wouldn't accelerate, that they want long term in terms of an interest rate, is much lower than I would expect that to be. And so that explains much of the difference, I think. So it's very low. It's like 2.5% or something is what they, so they don't expect to get to it for several years. They think that they're in a hot period, but they think that rates will be lower at, like you said, 3 rate cuts this year, then rates will go even lower the next year and then the next year. And they even have that the expected long-term neutral rate is much lower than I would think that the expected long-term neutral rate would be, consistent with 2% inflation. And so that's just an estimate that, and I don't know how you come up with that number. I don't mean that their number is better or worse, but I just mean it's a hard number to figure out, and I don't, and it's incredibly low compared to the long-term average past numbers would have to be. It's lower by about 2%. Yeah, so anyway, what they're saying is they think they're quite restrictive, whereas it may be that they're not much restrictive at all. It depends. You know, it could be, see, they would think that after 3 rate cuts, let's say they get down to 4.5%, that that's quite restrictive, whereas that could be neutral. We don't know.
It seems like things are, they feel pretty loose to me, the financial conditions. So I do wonder if you're going to get if you're going to get a spark again, inflation, and then what happens there. I mean, even looking at this Fed Watch tool, there's a 70% chance being priced in that they are going to cut 25 basis points in June, which I think is what a lot of people were looking for, to see, you know, the future dot plots and if they're going to cut, how many times they're going to cut, and what the Fed's view is on that. And it was definitely, I think it took people by surprise. I think a lot of people thought he would come out being much more hawkish, especially because we had a higher inflation print recently. And it seems like they're just going full steam ahead with the 3 rate cuts.
Yeah. Well, projections from just about everybody are for inflation to come down quite a bit over time. Like I said, I haven't, for the last 6 to 9 months, I think the data is noisy, but shows no trend towards getting better. If you exclude just goods prices that dropped a lot, you wouldn't expect goods prices to fall in a normal year. In real terms, they may have fallen in the past with China and stuff by 1 or 2%. It's possible that could happen. But, you know, what would happen is any turn up in the economy would cause an increase in goods prices. It's more sensitive to that. So you can see a drop and an increase. You know, the services and all that stuff isn't coming down a lot. Sticky inflation, which you talked about, isn't coming down a lot. So it's not going up, but I'd say for 6 to 9 months, it's been moving around the same sort of levels, you know, if you take any 3-month moving average or something. Generally, you know, if we just look historically, they're somewhat high interest rates, or Fed funds rate is maybe 325 basis points higher than what would be normal in the long term past. 4.5% or something would probably be normal in the long term past, 4 to 5%. But unemployment is a lot lower. It's like almost 2% lower. You know, so 5 to 6% unemployment would be more normal. So, I mean, they have a dual mandate. Like they said, they don't have a growth mandate, and so they want to maintain very high levels of employment. And they think that increasing rates any further would do damage to it. Right now, there's like a 0% odds being put on rates being higher at the end of this year. It's close to 0% last I checked. That does seem low. There's not no chance that they won't end up increasing rates before they decrease them. It's lower. It's more likely they'll cut rates than not cut them. and it's more likely they'll keep them the same than raise them, but it's not nothing. Do you have a, does it give you any information there on what the odds are this year that it would be at least 5.5 and above?
So let's see. So this looks like it goes, we could go to December, and yeah, basically it's pricing in nothing. The bulk of it is 35% chance to be at 4.5 to 4.7, but even being where we currently are at 5.25 to 5.5 is less than a 1% chance being currently priced in.
Yeah. But, you know, predictions for the future interest rates going out more than a few months are usually not accurate at all. They were inaccurate when they predicted them going up, and they're particularly inaccurate around pivots, you know. Powell did say that he doesn't want to cut rates only to have to raise them again. So that would be the biggest concern, that if they do it soon, that they may have to reverse themselves later. There's no reason to, you wouldn't cut based on what the data is now, but based on their projections, not just the Fed's, but everyone's projections, it would make sense to lower them, because inflation is coming down. So you lower them to keep the real rate low enough, like we said, to adjust it for the lower inflation. But if we stay at the same levels that we're at now without any further trending down, then I don't think it makes any sense to cut. You would probably leave rates the same.
He did talk about some quantitative tightening as well and rolling off their balance sheet. Just curious to hear your thoughts on like fiscal spending. We're still spending like crazy. I mean, do you think that's what's really kept the economy humming along in a pretty meaningful way?
I don't know, but that's hard to say. I mean, in the long term, you're going to need tighter, interest rates, if you're going to have very high levels of, spending. So that factors in more into the inflation stuff. I'm not really sure how much that has the effect on the economy. The biggest indication seems to be that the rate that the economy hasn't been very interest rate sensitive. It probably wasn't very interest rate sensitive before 2020, and it probably isn't very interest rate sensitive after. So it's probably a lot less interest rate sensitive than it used to be. But that may be that they just failed to tighten financial conditions for long to cause a decline in things. In the 1980s, they tightened financial conditions a lot, which affected things related to housing. The problem is that both coming out of the financial crisis, they had trouble stimulating housing, and now they're having trouble cratering housing by raising rates. So it's not being sensitive enough to what they need. And basically, the Fed only works through financial conditions through the housing market and stuff largely. There's other things, autos and stuff. But I think that if you put aside, you know, there's no mechanism for the Fed to affect inflation in like services and stuff. It's through other things. So, and you've seen with housing stuff, if anything, it's the housing is maybe getting a little more expensive, a little more active market than it was before. Mm-hmm. So, whereas, you know, a lot of what happened was slowing down housing and autos and stuff is probably most of what the Fed's accomplished so far. And strengthening the dollar actually too.
Bitcoin is at 65,000 again. So it's also been roaring. Curious to hear your thoughts on the yield curve that is still inverted. How does this work itself out? Does eventually the bond market start to price in higher? I mean, it either works if the Fed lowers the rates, their rates, right? Or does the bond market just start to price in higher inflation expectations long term, and the curve steepens and becomes uninverted? How do these things typically work themselves out? I mean, we've been inverted, it looks like, since July of 2022 or close to it. So it's got to be the longest one in history, at least in recent years. But how do these things typically work themselves out? And just curious how that relates to all the banking businesses that we look at and talk about on the podcast often.
Yeah, I don't know how it works out. I mean, as long as the there isn't a big change in terms of their predictions for the future here, that we keep not having a recession, basically. People keep expecting a recession, not having one, then I guess it could stay inverted indefinitely.
Does that eventually cause a recession, or?
It's causing lots of problems in the financial system, but
yeah.
So we've talked about money supply growth is like nothing, loan growth is like nothing, deposit growth is like nothing. So, but people may feel they're quite wealthy in terms of their homes, in terms of their stocks. That can change people's perceptions of a lot of things. Probably people's wages and stuff too. If you have surveys from people, I think they don't appreciate the extent to which their wages haven't actually gone up. So they feel like they're richer, but they also feel like there's too high, that things cost too much, but really they're not richer. So, you know, that happens. There'd been a long time where people weren't used to factoring in inflation into their thinking. So we're probably feeling a lot of the effects of that in terms of people's thinking. It's taking them time to adjust to it. You know, in terms of banks and everything, it depends. They're at a level for most of them where moves in the Fed funds isn't as significant as when they were coming off of zero. And so if you have a period of time where you stay at a certain rate for a while, most of that effect gets eliminated over time. You know, most banks will tell you that they don't really need the rates to be cut back down to a certain level as years go by at their staying at a constant level. Then they can adjust to that. It's really the moves in the rates over time, how fast they are and how big, that has the impact on them. And they estimate that in terms of their 10Ks and stuff. And you can see that, how sensitive they are to it. But you'll see that most of them will say that they're less sensitive now at 5% plus than they were at, you know, 1% or something.
What happened with New York Community Bank Corp? So we haven't done a podcast since all of the drama, the almost failure. Then Steven Mnuchin came in and made an investment in the company, which so far has sort of stabilized at least the stock price. But do you have any thoughts on everything that's gone on at New York Community Bank Corp? I mean, is this a similar situation to First Republic? What caused the downturn, the almost failure of this bank?
So we actually talked about this a little bit off the podcast of this bank, because I mentioned that this bank had once been a quite normal, safe bank. And then it made a decision a few years ago to go on an acquisition binge, merging with a bunch of different things. And although its name is New York Community Bank Corp, I think that a lot of its management and stuff is actually from what it acquired. So it just pivoted to go in a completely different direction. And it has exposures to unusual things. It acquired assets, in fact. And I was shocked when I saw that it was bidding for stuff originally, that we're talking about before, banks that had failed, because of, you know, that I didn't think it was a great bank to take on that kind of stuff. But that's not, I guess, what the FDIC and stuff is focused on, is what making sure that the healthiest banks are the ones that absorb this stuff, but based on like price and stuff like that. So maybe there might be a review by the government and stuff to think more about making sure that a bank that's in a better position to absorb troubled assets is the one who does it, instead of being the best bidder or something. I would guess that this is one that there'll be more investigation about public policy and stuff, about whether the right decisions were made on it. Not in terms of things being done illegally and wrong and stuff by the company, but just in terms of whether the regulators and stuff did everything right, because they may have treated the bank as stronger than it was for longer when it really pivoted and taking on a ton of unusual risks. But, you know, I want it to become a growth bank and stuff.
It seems to be when banks do run into trouble and you look at it after the fact, it seems like a lot of banks that become these growth banks and go and acquire a bunch of different things, they could end up in some trouble.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff with this bank that doesn't make a ton of sense. Like if you read their things, they'll say, well, we came over this threshold faster than we expected in terms of assets, which led to different regulation in terms of how we account for things and everything. But they hit that threshold not through organic growth, but through acquiring things. So they would have known they were going to do that. So, let's see how much you can see from QuickFS in terms of maybe balance sheet you can see. That'll give you a good idea if you just look more the last few years, so you can see the acquisitions I'm talking about. You can see total assets. Maybe that's the best gauge of size, probably.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's basically...
Do you see any points where there's a jump up?
Yeah, 2019, it was $53 billion, and now we're at $115 billion. So it went up a pretty big amount.
So, I mean, a similarity with all these banks is that it's brand new things being put on, either that they acquired or that they grew organically in the case of things like First Republic and all of that, too, that they, you know, doubled their balance sheet in a short period of time. So it's a lack of Diversification in terms of time is part of it. This bank also has a lack of diversification to some extent in terms of it has some exposure to specific things on loans that not everyone else does, because it has more large categories of kind of idiosyncratic loans. They're exposed to the same exact risk. But that was true also of, it's true, there's a couple banks in New York that have that, that have unusual risks that way. There's some that are backed by, they have a lot of things that are related to like rent controlled apartment stuff. There were some that were exposed with taxi medallions. There's one that focuses on law firms. You know, there's a few New York banks I can think of that have unusual exposures that way, which is fine if it's kept to a, if you're doing five different things that are totally different, you know, it's not a problem. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with if you were 20% exposed to agricultural loans in North Dakota and 20% to taxi medallions in New York and stuff, it wouldn't be a problem because the risks shouldn't be associated with each other. But, yeah. I mean, this happens. It'll continue to happen. I mean, I think Powell in the press conference said, you know, there'll be more bank failures in the future and stuff. It's just something that will always happen.
Mm-hmm. So where are you looking for opportunity now? We haven't talked a lot about just new ideas and interesting things that you've been looking at on the podcast. I mean, are you still having a hard time? I imagine even more of a hard time now with markets continuing to roar. I mean, do you ever go into it sort of with a backdrop of, okay, we're probably going to be in a higher inflationary environment, maybe I should look for things that could benefit from that? Do you ever think about that? Like Buffett buying more of Oxy, it seems like that's, he's setting his portfolio up for, you know, to benefit from higher inflation. Maybe take us through your current research.
Yeah, we're overexposed, you know, over-indexed. We are overweight by a tremendous amount. Things that have to do with like U.S. oil, things and stuff, as is Buffett. You know, I mean, if you take away like Apple or some of his biggest things, the stuff that he's been buying and everything, right? So he's just been buying stuff. He's buying something that I don't think we know what the stock is yet. But other than that, if we put that one aside, he's just been buying oil in the U.S. and the Japanese companies. So, you know, yeah, we have much more. We own more non-ESG stuff, more things that have to do with, as you said, I guess, you know, energy things, right? So it could have to do with fossil fuels and all of that, then is in the overall market. And then we don't have technology stuff. I don't know that oil things are incredibly cheap. In fact, I'd say they're not cheap. But they're okay. You know, I think there's oil things that you could get the returns that you used to get in the stock market. So Buffett did his annual letter, and I think the entire time he's been at Berkshire, the S&P averaged a 10% annual return. So if you're saying, can you get that 10% annual return somewhere? Maybe you can in oil, and maybe that's why he's in oil. So, but it's not cheap in a sense of like, do you expect to get much better returns than in the past? But you might be able to get the kinds of returns that people used to get in stocks, whereas in other things, I don't see how you can anymore. But, you know, that's a problem we've talked about before. I mean, in general, stocks have been more expensive. I think for the last 20 years or something, they're about 50% more expensive on average than they were in the years before 2000. And then now they're probably double on average what they were before 2000. So in the so today you're paying probably about double for any stock what it was in the 1900s in terms of multiple. That's probably the reality of what you're doing. So, you know, the return is not as good if you pay a higher price usually.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder in this current environment, but also just the way that since quants and computers drive a lot of the liquidity and most of the liquidity that happens daily, right? So at the beginning of this podcast, you had talked about US Lime, how over time you start to benefit from fund flows. It does make it very challenging if you own companies that perhaps don't get the benefit of those discretionary or non-discretionary, I should say, fund flows that happen. Do flows and thinking about that sort of stuff, do you think that's ever something that, you know, would be worthy to think about, like just positioning and flows of different things? I mean, we've seen how you could find interesting ideas by index deletions. So when companies get push out mm-hmm. of an index, you may get selling, really just looking for these reasons where people have to buy and sell for non-economic reasons.
Yeah, things that aren't included in indexes, things that are coming out of bankruptcy, things that are spinoffs and all of that are all possibilities if there's some reason why it would be inefficient. Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense. You know, what I was talking about is FICO, US Lime, J&J Snack Foods. Those are all things of a certain quality that when they're big, get astronomical pricing on them. People give them huge multiples. As tiny stocks, they don't have it. So it depends on, you could either buy it at a point where it's inflecting that way. I'll give you another one that's like that, Transcat, where the business has not gotten all that much better. It actually hasn't performed as well as a business as I hoped it would. But it's one that I was going to write up and stuff in Sealer Diligence years ago because they were changing their business in a way they thought would be good. And they've gotten some benefit from that. They have improved the quality of the business by focusing more on the service stuff. But the transition hasn't been as fast as I thought. But because of the kind of business it is, which has to do with measurement stuff and so sort of like serving labs and stuff, I think you can see the business description there will give you an idea of what I'm talking about. But because it was a very small company, as it got bigger, quality means a lot more in that and certain kinds of business models and stuff. And so when it's a very small company, people don't recognize it the same way as a stock. It doesn't appeal to the same people. And so it's gotten a tremendous re-rating in the stock that probably is not necessarily all that justified. But that could mean that it was very cheap before, you know? But you don't usually have very high multiples put on stocks that are not, like you said, bigger things that big funds and everything own. They're always looking for quality. There's never as much quality as they want to own and never as much growth as they want to own. You know, quality and growth are kind of strategies I think that people want to own more of than actually exists in the market usually. And so there's always like kind of a scarcity of that, you know? That's a way of thinking about it, is what stocks will go up. Well, the stocks will go up is what thing do people want to invest more in than there is to invest in. So you see that with AI now, right? They're stretching how far they're thinking, what does AI mean? Because they have to keep finding more and more marginal AI things, or they could only buy a couple stocks that are really the ones that are heavily exposed to AI, right? So if you want to be big in AI, then there's only so much stuff you can pick. You know, so that's what drives stock, sure. I mean, it's not what we do. We invest based on the business and looking at it as what we think the business is worth and not on the idea of what the multiples are. But the multiples are dramatically different for different companies. And you can see that, you know, when I bought FICO, it was a 10 times multiple basically. And historically now the last few years, it's been what, 70 times at times or something.
I wonder, right? So you look at like the 10-year CAGR on revenue, assets, free cash flow, I'm getting, but revenue, 7%. You're paying 66 times free cash flow. So how are they valuing this to get somewhat of a decent return? Like, how do you justify buying it at these levels?
There are people who run funds that have to invest in, there are a lot of people who run funds that have to invest in $1 billion up. There's tons that really need $10 billion up. And this is now in that category. It is an amazingly high quality company for being that size. There aren't a lot of companies. There are very few in the world that have the kind of quality of Fair Isaac. And so you might own some of it. I don't get it, but they're not comparing off of other things that you could do. And it's done very well in the last few years in terms of how much the increases have been, but it is complicated. One, they might be working off of earnings things. You have to remember Fair Isaac. So like FICO last year, I think you can read their 10K. Can you see how much their earnings went up in the last year or two?
Yeah.
On QuickFS, sure. So I could just explain this.
Okay, so earnings in 2021 were up. Well, really, yes. 2019, I'll just say the growth. 56%, 25%, 70%, 6%, 19%.
Okay. So let's say they're up like 20% in the last year. I believe all of that, if not all of that and more, is due to price increase. Pretty much. They have different segments, so I'm not 100% sure on that. But if you read the 10K, that's what it sounds like. So volume generally was flat to down while price was up by at least that much. And now, obviously, eventually, you price so high, your margins, this NVIDIA has the same issue and stuff, your gross margins get so big that as your gross margins are very high at the end, price increases are less impactful. Because actually, if you know that something's going to increase prices, you want something with really low margins to increase prices, because obviously it creates a much bigger gain in earnings. If almost all of your margin is already earnings, then when you do the price increase, it won't have the same effect. So you would rather, like, you know, own a coal company like we talked about with Met Coal, right? Where it's basically break even, but you know that they're going to raise prices 100% next year or something. If you could figure that out, that means earnings are going to go up by a huge amount. It, because your margins are like, you know, 10% and less. If your margins are like 80%, what's their gross margin say it is at FICO?
80%, 79%.
Yeah. My estimate is that the score segment of FICO, which is the key part of it, has historically, 10 years ago even, had a 70% operating one. So if we took out corporate costs and stuff, I think EBIT would be 70%. And they've never said that, but I'm pretty sure that it would be in that neighborhood. So it's something that could be like a 50% after-tax business or something if it had no corporate costs and no other segments. You know, people know what the FICO score is. It's a license to print money like a Moody's or something like that. And, you know, look, if there's a lot of inflation, they can keep raising the price in line with inflation. There's no doubt about that. So, because, I mean, I don't see a reason why they shouldn't capture the same percentage in the United States. It's sort of like title insurance or any of those things, like a percentage of the market. So let's say, you know, title insurance is something that's related to closing costs, what realtors or whatever, you know, closing costs should be a percentage of the overall housing market. So if you think the housing market in nominal terms will double or quadruple or whatever, if you think that the loan market will grow by a huge amount, you know, so as the amount of, if people believe that the amount of credit card debt and all sorts of other debt is going to increase by a lot, then they can believe in that with FICO. FICO also bought back stock and still does, but bought back stock that was more helpful in the early days, I think, than it is now, because I think the multiple's too high. I mean, I just think it's incredibly high price, but there's so many stocks where that's true, where, yes, I think there's wonderful things about it, but it's an incredibly high price. And so I don't know how you fix that problem. But, you know, if you look, we talked about NVIDIA, right? If you look at NVIDIA, people are basically pricing it on the expectation that it will quadruple in the next couple of years, its earnings at least. I don't know that it'll quadruple its sales and stuff, but they have to kind of estimate that, because what do we have on the, what's our sales? Yeah. So they have to, if they double sales next year and they double sales the year after that, then they'll be at a price to sales that will be kind of high for a growth stock, but not crazy, which would be like 9 or something. So, you know, so some people are counting on that stuff to happen. NVIDIA is a very good business. It's super fast growing and everything, and had historically earned good returns. Though, unlike FICO, there's a point in the cycle, usually the bottom part for 3 years or so, where they don't really earn their cost of capital. But anytime it gets scarce, they suddenly are earning tremendous returns. The one that's harder with NVIDIA is that the expectations for gross margin remain very high in analyst expectations. So in other words, they're telling you there's going to be tight supply for years into the future, which could be true. But like if we knew that about oil, if you can tell me that it's going to be tight oil supply for 2 to 3 years out, or tight supply of airline seats for 2 to 3 years out, then those things are great buys. It's just no one is willing to say, I can predict that oil will be tight for 3 years, or I can predict that airlines will be tight for 3 years. They are willing to predict that capacity can't meet demand for 3 years with AI stuff.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focus Compounding podcast. If this is the first time you are joining us, be sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you are listening or watching us here today. And of course, if you want to learn about our money management services, you can reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. I want to thank everybody so much for all the support. And we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.